Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Good morning and welcome to the Parenting Aces radio show on Blog Talk Radio's UR Tennis Network. I'm your host, Lisa Stone, and we have another great show for you today coming from chilly Atlanta. It is very, very brisk temperatures here outside. And in fact, we are on our second day of school cancellations in the rest of the country. Please don't laugh at us here in Georgia, but we really don't know how to manage ourselves when the temperatures drop into single digits and our roads can't handle it and our businesses and school buses can't handle it either. So we're all holed up here together, even though it really is truly a sunny, beautiful day out. It is cold and we're enjoying not having to get up early 2 days in a row for school. So there you go. Today I have on the air with me Trent Aaron, and I'm really excited for him to be on the show. We've been trying to make this happen for a few months now. Trent and I first met each other at a Futures event in Alabama a few months ago. My son was playing in that event, and Trent was there coaching some players, and he and I struck up a conversation, and he's just such an interesting guy. I know you guys are going to love listening to his stories and hear the information that he has to share. Let me just give you a little bit of background on him, too, because he comes from a very wide range of experiences in the tennis world, and so I think he's going to be able to offer a pretty interesting perspective on this game for us. He has been playing since he was 6, but kind of seriously since he was 11. He played in the juniors, and he played for his high school, and then played college tennis at Transylvania University, where he worked his way up to the number one singles player there, and had a very successful collegiate tennis career. He went out on the tour after college and had some success there as well, and eventually moved himself down to Southern California, which is, any of y'all who follow me and all my posts know that I consider Southern California to be tennis mecca. So that's where Trent wound up, and he has continued to play on the professional level and in men's open events around the world, actually. He coaches several kids. He has worked with some incredible coaches over the years, and I'll let him talk more about that. And one of the things that has really kind of made Trent stand out in the tennis world is he's worked with Brian Battistone and his family on the two-handled racket. And for those of you who aren't familiar with the two-handled racket that Brian developed, Google it and take a look at some of the video online. It's very, very cool. So before I bring Trent on the air with me, I want to play a quick ad for StopSportsInjuries.org. And when we come back, we will have with us Trent Aaron.
Warning. Orthopedic surgeons are seeing an increase in overuse injuries when young athletes perform the same repetitive stressful motions over and over. Pitching, tennis, weight training, even long swimming workouts can cause overuse trauma that may require surgery. If your kids play and train hard, visit orthoinfo.org or stopsportsinjuries.org. A message from the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons and the American Orthopedic Society for Sports Medicine.
Welcome back to the Parenting Aces radio show on Blog Talk Radio's UR Tennis Network. I'm your host, Lisa Stone, and I just want to apologize right now for any noises you may hear in the background today. As I mentioned before, school has been canceled yet again here in Cobb County, Georgia, and my son is in and out getting himself ready to hit the tennis courts. So you may hear some foot traffic, some voice traffic in the background, and I apologize for that. All that said, I want to welcome on the air with us today Trent Aaron. And Trent, are you with us?
I'm here, Lisa.
Awesome.
Are
you there? Thank you so much. And I know you're visiting our side of the U.S. today. You're down in Florida. I hope it's a lot warmer there than it is up here in Atlanta, but I'm just so glad you could be with us and we could finally coordinate our schedules well enough to make this work.
Yes, I'm in South Florida, and I haven't actually been here in about 5 years, but I swear this is a beautiful tennis community they have down here. I mean, they have so many courts, and they got the Del Rey tournament going on, and I just swung over. It was a coincidence that you wrote on Eric Quigley, who happens to be from my home state, and I got to watch him play Chase Buchanan in his first round, and then he's still going. He beat another really good player, and having, I think, you know, his best run at a ATP event. And so, I mean, it's, you know, as far as watching, and they just have so much going on down here, it's perfect.
That's fantastic. So I kind of build this show that you would be talking with us about a healthier way to play tennis. And given that the Parenting Aces audience is comprised mostly of parents of junior and collegiate players as well as some coaches, what does that mean, a healthier way to play tennis? Can you kind of give us some background and some insight onto what you're thinking?
Well, as you stated in your intro there, you know, I've had an association with the Battistone family, who was a family that that we were coached by the same. We had an Australian coach in Southern California who had coached Jimmy Pugh and, you know, a number of players. I think Jimmy Pugh was probably his most famous pupil. And we had started, you know, they were, Dan, Brian's older brother, had been with him for 7 years. And then I saw how he improved. And I was actually coaching a college team, a Division I school in California. And I said, gosh, Dan, you've improved. He got up to number one in the Open in Southern California. And I said, I want to go wherever you're going. I want to go there. So he introduced me to this coach. And so I was with him for actually 7 years. He was a mentor. And he also coached Brian for about 3 years. And that's kind of what bonded us. So we had sort of this same type of background. And then Brian, both of those guys were raised Mormon. Dan's still, you know, a devout Mormon. Brian was raised Mormon and reads various things. But they both went on missions. And Brian was always dreaming up new ways to play tennis. And you know, for my money, I think he's probably the most entertaining player on the planet to watch. So I've been friends with him since he was 17, coached him a little bit traveling, and now he's 35. He's still playing, but we're both sort of in a player coach role. And he came up with another inventor, Lionel Burt. They've started, you know, wouldn't tennis be great if you were hitting left-handed and right-handed? And people say, oh, that, you know, that's impossible. But, you know, I've been right-handed all my life. And Brian started this idea of, and actually, I don't want to misrepresent that we were the people that invented double-handle tennis, because double-handle tennis rackets have been around for actually 100 years, and different people have tried different versions. And so anyway, he created this type of tennis, and I started using it initially for the sort of the competitive advantages, which would be the reach and the leverage, and I felt like I had maxed out, you know. I often tell people that I got to a point in my tennis career where I thought it would be impossible to beat Roger Federer with a one-handle racket, but maybe a two-handle. So that's what led us to starting to use it. And Brian, actually, you know, for 200 years, everyone had hit a standing serve, you know, our traditional serve, and then he came up with this volleyball jump serve totally on his own. And, you know, he was gone for 3 months. I was traveling with Dan, and I said, where's Brian? He said, oh, he's working on something. And then no one knew where he was, and he went off and into Utah and got a court and just for 3 months practiced this volleyball jump serve. And he's, you know, he, some people call him a YouTube phenomenon and stuff like that. So, and it is actually, I actually have probably the second best jump serve on the planet that I know of, I should say that, because I started imitating him too. And at first I thought, gosh, this is all just for show or whatever. But, you know, we honestly believe that it's going to bring back the serve and volley because it puts you about 6 feet closer on your first volley. I mean, if I just saw an article 3 days ago where Sampras was interviewed and said, yeah, you know, serving and volleying is totally extinct, you know, and that I grew up in an era where that was all you did. You know, I mean, I think I chipped and charged and served and volleyed on every first serve. You know, this is late 80s. And now the sport, many people say, because of the strings, and I actually don't think the rackets are any more powerful, maybe a little bit, but I think it's the string technology has made it so that the ground strokes are so good that, it, you know, it's almost useless to serve and volley because, you know, and if you approach deep, everyone says hit your approach shots deep. If you hit your approach shots deep these days, I mean, the 14, 15-year-old kids will take 3 steps over and hit it by you so fast you won't even know what hit you. So, you know, the sport's evolving. We're hopefully leading, you know, I call it a tennis evolution revolution, which is getting people to wake up to using the other side of their brain, the other side of their body. We say you wouldn't go to the gym and do curls with just your right arm, but that's what most tennis players are doing when they play. They're, you know, they serve all right-handed, you know, and it starts at an early age. I think it's a total, I actually really believe that this is the next step in evolution, or I wouldn't be as passionate about it. You know, when you come out and you see a kid for the first time take his first tennis lesson, you'll often see, you know, the kid, you know, someone will say, hey, you know, put that racket in your hand, you know, hit a backhand. You know, and backhands are beautiful, and we actually promote hitting two backhands, a left-handed and a right-handed, and you know, but if you honestly just give a kid a chance and just start throwing balls, you know, they don't even know if they're left or right-handed. They'll hit, you know, and they'll throw the racket back and forth. It's more natural to actually, we feel like, play our way. So, you know, in school, someone will say, oh, you know, or even parents will be, oh, look, my kid's going to be a lefty, you know, and then they start sort of reinforcing that behavior, but I think we all have a natural tendency to sort of be ambidextrous, and it takes a little bit of concentration and a little bit of focus and a lot of practice to sort of develop that side of your body and get that full brain, full body, you know. And I was listening to your advertisements about the orthopedics and people talking about, you know, overuse injuries. But if you're constantly loading one side of your body, to serve in a tennis match, you're going to create what we call lopsided bodies. And this is coming from someone that played 25 years of one-handed tennis and ended up with just that, a lopsided body. And, you know, I've had, you know, still working my way back through, you know, it takes me an hour of Agoscue training or stretching, you know, just to be able to play 2 hours of tennis, even to this day. And when I get out of it, you know, my body gets very out of aligned and painful and stuff like that. So, any other questions, Lisa?
Well, it's so funny because my son has a buddy that it lives in the Atlanta area too, and they play practice matches with each other from time to time. And his buddy plays both hands on both sides, so he has two-handed forehand, two-handed backhand, and but he serves left-handed. And I was watching them play over the weekend, and it's so interesting to watch this kid. He's one of the top-ranked juniors in our section, and to sit behind him and try and figure out where his ball is going to go is near impossible.
The disguise.
Yeah. I mean, it's just crazy. And I brought that up to my son after they played this weekend. I was like, how do you know where to go? You know, when you hit him the ball, how do you have any clue where it's coming next? And he said, it's next to impossible. He just, they play enough now that I guess he's learned his patterns, but it's just it's fascinating to watch.
Oh, it's interesting you should say that because, you know, Brian, that was, you know, at one point, I think in the, you know, I'm not exactly sure which year, sometime in the 90s when he started thinking about this, there was four players in the top 50 the top 50 of the ATP rankings that were two-handed both sides, you know, Byron Black, Jan Michael Gamble, Fabrice Santoro, and a Dutch player named Ramon Sluiter. So, I mean, he was into that disguise factor that you talk about. And it was just, and Monica Seles, I mean, no one, she was actually one of our partners in the company that is an owner of the company, had a deal worked out with her to create our racket. And she was behind it. She hit with a prototype, and there was a disagreement about how much money would go. But she was actually, when she was, this is, you know, what I've heard, she was going to be a part of developing the racket, and somehow it fell through. But later we all got it together, and, you know, that's it. We're just, here we are. We have two versions. I can't believe I'm down here in Florida, and I met a guy and practiced with him last night who uses one of our versions that we don't really push that much anymore because we're like, oh, we don't want to confuse the public. And Brian actually used it on the tour. He switched to it. I mean, this is how much of a risk taker he is. You know, we all thought it was going to be an improvement from the original, and it's called the Diamond. And there's a guy down here that's using it. He won two USPTA doubles titles, and I think he's got like a gold ball, or maybe not a gold, like a bronze. He's done really well, and I had never even, you know, he just picked up our racket online, and he actually liked the one that we're not really promoting that one that much. And after hitting with him last night, I said, I think this is great for players that have a one-handed backhand and they want to play a two-handled racket. And then I actually taught him a shot with the racket because I used it for 10 months myself. And another history on Brian actually beat the guy that won Wimbledon, I think, in 2010, Jonathan Murray or Frederick Nielsen, one of those guys. He beat him in doubles 2 months before with that version of the racket. And then 2 months later, he won Wimbledon. And so, anyway.
Very cool.
That's just,
very cool.
Yeah.
So, yeah. People that watch the videos of the two-handled racket and Brian's jump serve, I mean, one of the questions that comes up is that legal in tennis? And and it is, yeah? I mean, there's no rule against either one of those things.
Oh, it's totally, and if you ask me that before 10 a.m., then you have to buy me a beer at 6 a.m. Now, that's what I always tell people. If we had a nickel for every time people asked if it was legal, we'd be billionaires by now. But we do get asked that. And yes, you know, our racket is, you know, Dan and Brian played the Newport, Rhode Island. It's actually in the Hall of Fame. If you go to the Rhode Island Newport Hall of Fame, they have a version of our original red racket there. And a lot of times people that are there and they send us pictures. And you know, Brian played Wimbledon qualies and doubles once and U.S. Open twice. And, you know, getting a racket legalized is not much to, you know, I always tell people, if you can beat Roger Federer with a snowshoe, they'll let you use it. Or, you know, there's not many specifications. It has to be under 29 inches. But when we started all this, we had to send prototypes to the ITF, and then they send, you know, we used to have to carry a letter with us, you know, and to tournaments and pull it out and say, look, you know, this is ITF legal. And we had people, I mean, I honestly I was playing like it would be the equivalent of playing the Georgia State Championship 40s. And this is in Germany, and they weren't going to let me use the racket. They're like, nope, he's out of the, you know, you can't play the tournament with that racket. And I was like, well, I can't play with my racket, I'm going home. And then I was getting ready to leave.
Seriously.
And somebody looked it up, and they're like, you know, I mean, there's no way I could do anything with a single hand. I mean, in about 8 days, I probably could. You know, it's never really the racket. It's the player behind the racket. And, you know, I wish I knew that with surfboards, because I keep buying surfboards thinking that one's going to make me surf like Kelly Slater, but none of them do.
I'm going to ask you.
But I do understand it in tennis.
Right. Trent, do you mind seeing if you can up your volume again? I know you've got a headset on. Maybe put the mic a little closer.
Is that better? I don't know where the mic is.
You just keep fading in and out on my end, and it may just be me.
Oh, we got to start all over again.
No. We're good. Okay, so let's talk about this from an injury prevention standpoint, this natural approach to the game. When you get a new player, or maybe they're not new to tennis, but they're new to you as a coach, how do you take them through the process of adjusting to playing both sides of their body?
Well, there's been, and I understand this phenomenon because I was that way. When the Battistones, these are two guys that really didn't do anything with a single handle racket, they accomplished stuff, they got a couple ATP points here and there, and then they came out with this racket and they started playing, and with the competitive advantages and stuff like that, within 2 years I think they got to 120 in the world. And these are guys that played with a single handle racket for like 4 or 5 years. So, but I was seeing them in that process. I was friends with them, and I used to, be really even with them when they used the one-handle racket. And then they started beating me. I mean, it wasn't even funny. I would say they were bending my wrist back, because of the leverage and the power that they were able to produce. But I was like, God, I've played for 28 years, and I don't want to give up all that knowledge of, that I've built up, and taken me so long to get this good. And I think at the time I had like 5 ATP points or something in doubles, and it'll take me a whole year. But it's really not that difficult of a learning process, and it's, like I said, it's kind of like a surfboard. It's you can use any racket, but it is, I say, a 10-day process, and it's not a comfortable process. When you start playing with it, and I always tell everyone, be late on everything, meaning the racket's already in front of your hand because of the angle that it's shaped at. So you have to kind of move your contact point back, and then a lot of the recreational and senior players that were getting there, they're like, yeah, that's easy for me, I'm late on everything, so so it can be easier, but people are like, wow, you really want me to be late? You're the first coach that's ever told me that. But the contact point, I felt like I played with it 2 hours a day for 6 days. On the seventh day, I feel like I would have beaten myself. And we're sort of in the process of doing a challenge with people where we get them like, hey, play your favorite practice partner, someone who really is, you win one time, they win the next time. Play that guy a set, and then use our racket for 10 days, and then play him a set again, and tell us, if you do a little bit better, or, and then I honestly feel like I would have beaten myself after 10 days. Now, there's other natural tennis players that will tell you, hey, it took me 6 months, it took me 7 months, and you will get better than just that initial 10 days, but there is a whole process. We are still in the process of filming, the lessons and the various shots, because there's so much that you can do with it. I mean, it creates all these different possibilities. But I would encourage people to know that it's not really that long, and it's definitely well worth the effort of making the change and putting the time in to see if you can get better. So using it, or less pain. And most of our players, are a lot of the players I coach, a pediatrician, so many players that have come to our racket where they were told by doctors, like, hey, tennis isn't for you. You are in so much pain. You're never, this guy, I think, had a stroke in his arm, and, he had wrist problems, and his hand. But there's so many people. We have another lady, double carpal tunnel surgery, a single-handled tennis racket hurt her too much. I've had the tennis elbow surgery, a version of it called a radial tunnel release. This is when I was using a single handle racket. I mean, it's so the vibration going down two handles is a lot less. And I think the senior players get, if you see people after 70, like reaching across their body to hit a backhand volley, it becomes painful. you know, just because of the joints and the wear and tear on your shoulders. And you'll see, if you watch older 70 to 80 year old players, they often throw the racket into their left hand and hit a left-handed shot, just because they know it's going to feel better on their body.
Interesting. And
yeah.
I'll have to watch my dad a little more closely next time I'm home.
Yeah. No, watch it. I mean, you will see people in the park. And then, so they totally get us. When they meet us, they go, wow, you know, this, you know, and you put it in their hands. So a lot of our market has been people like that. And then once they do switch, you know, and then they get, we get made fun of so much. But, you know, we've heard it all. We've heard every joke. So they get sort of grounded in it. It's almost like having an exotic pet or something. You know, everywhere you go, it's like having a boa constrictor around your neck. And it creates such conversation. And people say, God, what's that? And we say, oh, look, you got two hands, two handles, two feet, two shoes. It makes total sense. And there's a pro. go ahead.
I mean, do y'all honestly see this as becoming part of a mainstream tennis protocol, whether in the juniors, on the pro tour, or in, you know, on the senior circuit? I mean, is that the goal, is to make this a mainstream option?
Well,
for people,
we feel like there will always be people that will, you know, there's some people that you meet that will never, you know, give it a try. And I think that's what makes it so challenging and fun for us, you know, because you develop friends that are, you know, you start to use your whole body, but you're also using your whole brain, and you become a better problem solver. I mean, a lot of this is I see a lot of your articles, and, you know, there's a lot of stuff in the media about tennis these days, like, and the money and how lowly paid, you know, say the number 150 player in the world is compared to, say, the number 150 baseball player in the world or basketball player. And you know, a lot of this we brought about because we're like, gosh, how can we generate income but also share, you know, a healthier way to do things that will cause people less pain and sort of bring about, you know. And there's a whole other process that, as I was saying, I was just into the leverage. You know, when I first, you know, when you hit a smash with our normal racket, I was one of these guys that was pretty good at doubles. And I worked on my smash. I wanted to have it, you know, but I would sometimes have to hit 8 or 9 smashes to win a point, you know, because guys would be running it down. And, you know, when you hit a smash with our racket, the point's usually over, you know, like it doesn't come back because it has this sort of natural leverage pulling down motion. It's almost like dunking a basketball, but it has a fulcrum that once you start the swing, it just times your swing perfectly, like at the time that you should be snapping your wrist. Whereas I always think that a one handle person has to tell their wrist, you know, like, okay, now's the time to snap, you know, or now's the, you know, whereas ours, you just swing the racket and it snaps for you. So there's definitely, there's another, so that's what I was into in the beginning, was all of the type of advantages. And I was like, God, there's so much reach and disguise and stuff like that. But then I started looking at him and go, gosh, he hits a lot more left-handed, you know, he is getting a full brain. So then, now we promote a system, or I sell people a book, or I sell, you know, people, there's a thing called Whole Brain Power. And it was an ambidextrous tennis player from Southern California, a guy that went out and he actually got on David Letterman, and he created a whole system for developing your ambidexterity. I don't know if you've heard about the book 7 Habits for Highly Effective People. And
sure.
It's by Stephen Covey, and, you know, one of his is Lead From. So you start to, you know, brush your teeth with your left hand as opposed to your right. You know, when you're doing that, you're sending messages. And then people always think, gosh, I don't know if I could ever get my left hand as strong as my right. And it's actually not about strength building as much as it is sending as many messages. So that doesn't mean you have to actually go out and physically practice left-handed tennis. I mean, you're going to be doing that too, you know, but you can do it mentally. You know, you've heard about the people that say you shoot foul shots. You know, there's, you know, they do studies where they had people actually go out and do practice their foul shooting 300 a day, and then they had another that just shot 300 in their mind, you know, and they didn't actually physically shoot. And then they do a contest that the end of 6 weeks or whatever it is. I could be totally off on, you know, and the people that mentally shot, you know, foul shots actually increased their ability. So there's so much visualization, things that you can do, practice. And once you start to develop that, Michael Lavery is the name of the guy that wrote the book Whole Brain Power. He came out with a system, you know, handwriting in our school. It's like, I hear that in the public school systems now, they're not even teaching penmanship. And if you read his book, it's a pretty heady book. I always suggest that people go straight to the how-to. How do I become ambidextrous? I mean, if you want to read about the science and all that in the book, it's great, but it's way above my head. I mean, I'm a jock. You know? But I always tell people, go straight to the how-to, and you will, if you want to read about it, it's pretty cool. But if you look at the penmanship, you know, our president, and since the, you know, if you look at the handwriting of like Benjamin Franklin or all these people, I mean, they had exquisite penmanship. This is how you develop your brain. You know, it's through the fingertips, the touch. And if you start to work on your penmanship, I mean, in our schools these days, I mean, I hear that there's kids that, you know, they just constantly print. I mean, I was one of those kids. I mean, I didn't have that good of penmanship. Since then, I've started working on my penmanship. Then you start to work on your left hand handwriting, and in the beginning, you're like, wow, this looks crazy bad. But all the information is on one side of your brain, and it starts to come through. So it becomes like a meditation. You know, you start eating left-handed, using chopsticks left-handed. There's tons of ways throughout the day to work on the other side of your brain. And I got one lady that was debating me in Hawaii. She said that it's not actually proven that if you do all these things that you fend off Parkinson's and Alzheimer's and stuff like that. Cause I used to always say that. I used to say, oh yeah, you know, it prevents all, cause, you know, I'm careful to not just throw that out, but it's been said that possibly that it does prevent or help in the aid of holding it off. And, you know, so much of what you're doing and what people all over, you know, every sport, you know, I mean, if you're looking at our Super Bowl these days, I don't want to say that they're total facts, but I heard that there were $850 million put into paying off. The NFL had to pay last year for early, you know, dementia and Alzheimer's from concussions. I mean, all sports are moving in a healthier way, or we're working to prevent that. You know, it's like soccer heading the tennis ball these days, or heading the soccer ball is, you know, I hear that that's bringing on dementia and Alzheimer's and stuff like that. They're doing their best to make soccer ball. So it's, you know, we've gotten so strong, so fast, so, you know, but a lot of the things that we're doing may not be super healthy, and football and soccer. And so, you know, if we can make tennis, you know, a little bit less stress on your arms and make it so you can play, I mean, it is a sport for a lifetime. It keeps you active. I mean, even normal or even single-handed tennis, all tennis is healthy. I mean, Dodo Cheney just, you know, she won 300 national championships. I mean, this is like, you know, she was 100-plus years old still playing tennis. You know, I mean, it definitely keeps you alive, keeps you active. If perchance that, you know, there's a few people, there will always be people that play traditional tennis. We hope that it'll be a mainstream thing. And, you know, right now most of our players are what I call part of the intelligentsia, are really bright people that kind of are able to say, oh, wow, you know, this may be coming and this does feel better. So hopefully it becomes mainstream, but we'll see.
Are you seeing much of it on the junior circuit when you go out with the young guys that you coach?
You know, it's funny that you should say that, because we're down here with a team of, you know, two twins or a set of twins that I just took them to a tournament. You know, Brian's coaching them all the time, and then I take them to a tournament and they win their first, they just won their first junior tournament in Florida. You know, they're 17 and they are playing single-handed, you know, and they're kind of their original coach. And then now Brian's their coach, and they're always wanting to go that route. They're actually doing a lot working on their ambidexterity and playing single handled tennis and playing well. We're not saying you have to use our racket, but it's I think the Michael Avery book documents, you know, that a lot of great athletes, including Kobe Bryant, Wayne Gretzky, Michael Jordan, were all completely ambidextrous. I mean, you can see Kobe shooting three-pointers sometimes, you know, left-handed, you know, and foul shot, you know, so it's something that can help all sports, your life in general. We're not saying just our racket is going to do that, but gosh, I kind of got off on a tangent there. What were we saying? What were we talking about?
How many junior players are you seeing using that?
You know, I mean, it's a tough sell because tennis is a really traditional, you know, it's like we're just now also starting to sell tennis gloves. You know, I mean, I've been known as the guy on the tour that wore gloves, you know, for 12 years. Why? Because, you know, my hands would crack and bleed if I didn't wear them. You know, I had dry skin. I lived in California. We get Santa Ana winds. You know, I would be playing, you know, in December with like a pound of tape on my hands. Rafa Nadal and Gail Monfils right now. I mean, they're putting so much tape on their hands just to play normal tennis. They might as well be wearing gloves. And then that's a whole nother patented technology that's out there. You know, there's quarterbacks using gloves. It's definitely, gosh, I'm losing. Get me back on track again, Lisa. What were we talking about?
How popular the technique is.
Yeah, and so we have juniors that are using the racket. We have a kid right now in Portugal that's number 30 in the 12s, you know, coming. His dad was able to see that. There's tons of videos. If you sign up on Facebook for ambidextrous tennis, his name's Cesar Borja. We have a 12-year-old in Florida that I hit with the other day named Esteban, completely ambidextrous, hitting two forehands. You know, we always say, everyone says, run around your backhand and hit a forehand. Why not have two forehands? But I also say, why not have two backhands? You know, it's like Stan Wawrinka right now. I mean, he opened my eyes to the power of the backhand last year when he won the Australian Open, and I think that's the most dangerous shot on the court. Federer, you know, it's like, you know, he's able to angle it, but you can do that with the two-handle racket. And that's, you know, we get that question a lot, as people going, you know, but I had a one-handed. And so there are coaches out there that are using it, but a lot of times, you know, you're at a facility and, you know, there's a lot of powers that be in tennis. And, you know, I remember when the first Babolat came out, they made it basically, I feel like, because of the strings. They already had all the top players in the world, and they had this money base behind them. So they were able to go to the Orange Bowl. And they, I think, like 10 of the top juniors, you know, they just, the Pierre Babolat went there and it's like, here's some rackets, you know, giving them away. And they were able to, you know, so the powers that are there, but a lot of times at facilities you have coaches who are kind of like, oh, wow, I don't know how to teach this natural tennis stuff. You know, this is like, you know, and they're grounded in sort of keeping what they know is going. And so, you know, we have coaches in San Diego that practice and compete with a double handle racket. But when they go to work and they're working under a head pro, they teach with a single handle racket, you know, it's like, because they don't want, you know, and so it becomes hard to reach certain juniors. You know, I have probably 5 or 6 kids in LA that I teach, you know, and even that, you know, it's like, I was at a facility, you know, they would show up with their double handle racket. And then, you know, when I was working at a facility, this is like within a year ago, you know, my boss his kids are number one in the nation. You know, they're very heavily invested or believe in the Babolat, you know, and they'd come up to these kids and be like, why are you using Trent's stupid racket? You know, like, and these kids would look at him and go, because he wanted me to, you know. So it becomes difficult, you know, when you have people. But it's, like I say, it's challenging. And
oh, Trent, we just lost you. So I'm hoping you will dial right back into the show if you're listening. To my listeners, I apologize. I don't know what happened. He got booted off here, but I'm going to get back to him and get him to call right back in. While we're waiting for him, oh, here he is. That was quick. Trent, you back?
Yes, I'm back. See, they don't want the general public to know all this stuff. They're keeping it from you.
Yeah, I don't know what happened. You just all of a sudden cut out on us. But I wanted to ask you, too, because this was something that was really interesting to me. When I met you in Birmingham, one of the moms of the kids that you coach was there, and she was telling me that one of her children is autistic and has been using this natural approach. And I don't remember if she said he was using the two-handled racket, but she was talking about how this approach to tennis was so therapeutic for an autistic child. Can you talk about that with us and tell us a little bit more about how you came up with that?
Oh, I don't know that I can state that it hasn't scientifically been proven. You know, we do have some users that are, say, one guy is teaching. He teaches tennis and volunteers at a prison, you know, and I always say, you know, so I've donated a couple rackets and say, you know, keep them using their lefty. It'll balance them out, you know, it'll get a but yes, she actually, you know, she's the mom that's down here with us, and she wrote a book that you know, all the doctors told her son was autistic and would never, you know, and she didn't believe the doctors, and she took a natural approach, and she got into this homeopathic, and luckily she was in a position where she could afford that, sort of go outside the box. And actually, Jamie just got it to the third round of the futures down here. You know, we're hoping to get him nationally ranked so he can get into all the futures. That's sort of the first step. He's only 17, super talented. And I think the name of the book is Jamie, Can You Hear Me Now? And, you know, with autism, it's definitely something that's been brought to my awareness as far as, I think they're talking about GMOs and our food supply, and just, you know, it could be something that's becoming more and more prevalent. And it's like, you know, it's pretty amazing what she's done. I mean, to think that this kid was ever diagnosed as autistic, because he showed zero signs of it. I mean, I would, if you met him, he's probably the most polite, fair, balanced, friendly, you know, just intelligent, witty, smart, you know, so he's got all these things going for him, and you would never know that he was diagnosed as autism. So I don't know that he is doing a lot of the ambidextrous work. He is a left-handed serve. He's still not using our racket, because it's like he had this original coach who was actually a great player, won the NCAAs and doubles, and I don't know if it's a loyalty to that, or he might be like me still, you know, thinking like, gosh, it's going to take me a whole year to get good. You know, I've been using this racket my whole life. You know, it's going to take me at least 2 years. So we often talk about it. I do my best to not push it, even though I'm constantly joking about, you know, like we got all these half-brain or half-butt, you know, like tennis, but, you know, the mom actually who wrote the book, she's one of our, I mean, we probably have 8 females on the planet using the racket. It would actually help females, I believe, more than males, because I think the only difference between, say, Serena and the guys is, well, actually, you know, Serena served, I take that back, Serena's got a guy serve, but the average female serve is slower than the average male, or, you know, if you took like the number, you know, typically. But our racket, I don't know, I always get in trouble if I say it adds power, but it adds leverage, and it adds sort of height on the way that your ball kicks up, and it adds like more slice, because you have this counter effect of what the racket's doing to the ball. So, but she, she who wrote the book is, you know, a big believer in the technology, and, you know, these kids are being trained ambidextrously, but they're using a one-handle racket, which I must say, you know, people always say, why don't you just use a one-handle? Why'd you come up with this racket? There was a guy in France, you know, ideas come about on a mass scale, and a lot of times, and, you know, a kid came up, he was half French and half Scottish, and I think he was 702 in the world ATP, and the guy serves left-handed, serves right-handed, hits a right-handed forehand and a left-handed forehand with a one-handle racket. And we actually sent him a prototype. We're like, hey, we want you to use our racket. I don't know, whatever. I haven't followed up with him lately. But, you know, even just the idea of ambidexterity, he was an example. Now, for me, I can't imagine trying to return a serve where you had to throw the racket back and forth like that, you know, like, and as we talked about before, I mean, two-handed both sides is proven to, you know, there's been there's been a high percentage of players that have done really well in that way. It does, you know, Bartoli, you know, but even just the idea of, I think 2 years ago, Rafa Nadal won Roland Garros and Maria Sharapova won Roland Garros. And both of those people, if you see Rafa signing autographs, he signs them right-handed. You know, they always say Tony Nadal tied his hand behind his back and taught him to play, made him a lefty. And it's like, you know, he's a perfect example. He's doing everything right-handed, but he plays tennis left-handed. And Sharapova was the exact opposite. She does that. She's actually a lefty. This is what I hear. Again, there's no way of me proving it, even though I do know her a little bit. But she was in Russia. They made everyone do everything right-handed. So when she went to learn to play tennis, but you'll often see her take a hand off and hit a left-handed forehand at times. And they say that she's left-handed and everything else. I don't know that for sure, but so I can't really make those same statements. But, you know, there's two examples of two athletes that are ambidextrous right there, you know, and winning.
Right. I mean, yeah, I don't think anybody could argue with either of them their success. So. Yeah, pretty crazy. But in terms of using this natural approach in a therapeutic manner, is that something y'all are looking into, kind of expanding into that arena a little more, or not so much yet?
No, I mean, we definitely... we do. I mean, it seems like we get a high number of players coming to us because they're in such pain with, like, single handle. But, yeah, for mentally, I haven't really, you know, I'm a big encourager of everybody getting the book Whole Brain Power and developing their offhand and stuff like and doing, you know, as much as they can with their offhand. But, yeah, there's definitely a therapeutic. You're giving me ideas here, but perhaps we could even do more with it. We just got to figure out what's the best way to do that.
Right.
Yeah.
I think it would be kind of a cool deal to see where it goes with that. I mean, I know, like, my middle child rides horses, and horses are used so much in therapeutic programs, you know, to help people with all sorts of things from mental illness to physical impairment to mental impairment. I mean, just all kinds of issues. And wouldn't it be cool if tennis could kind of be part of that therapeutic process as well? I think there's a lot to be said, especially because of the individual nature of the game, you know, that it would be a great tool to help people that needed that kind of help.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit more about, you know, getting the word out in terms of your work in the junior tennis world and the coaching side of things. What is your thought process around junior tennis development, where we're headed? Because there's so much conversation right now, especially as we're all waiting to hear who Patrick McEnroe's replacement is going to be at player development with USTA. You know, this talk about we're just failing in the U.S. in terms of developing players, I take issue with that. I think we're doing a great job. I think we have some really talented kids in the pipeline and some really hardworking kids. What do you see as a coach from the kids you work with? Are you seeing a problem with motivation or with athleticism or commitment or discipline? Or do you think it's just, you know, things run in cycles and we just happen to be on the, you know, downside of the cycle right now?
Well, you know, if you ever look at my history and the coaching that I was, you know, I had the mentor that encouraged me to get out and get out of the U.S. And you know, I always say that I think there's like a statistic that like 88% of the world's pros, you know, in the top 100 or something like that, you know, they were all raised in Europe. But I'm a big believer in not doing so much the USTA at home to develop players as much as, say, get the kids traveling. You know, it's like you want to get a kid good on clay. You know, that's what one of the reasons we're down here, even though I don't really feel like we should be down here. I think with, you know, we're developing these two kids, I feel, and our plan is to go to Europe for the, you know, for the spring and the summer and the fall. That's in Europe, you know, they have a lot more points, ATP points. I'm talking about pro development. So over there, you know, it would be the equivalent of our state. This is in the getting into the pro game, you know. So at the same time that you have a tournament in France, you have one in England, you have one. These are all like it's like our states, whereas we'll have one tournament, you know, lower ranking tournament to get the first points to be able to get in. For 250 or 300 million people, you know, we'll have one in one state, we'll have it in Texas one week, you know. So you've got players coming from all over North America. You know, it's so much more competitive. I mean, to even just get a doubles ranking, it's like these people are down here, you know, the qualies are 128, whereas in Europe, you know, things are a lot more spread out because there's a lot more tournaments. You know, every single country, I mean, if you look at how many futures, and, you know, Italy, they have one every single week for, it'd be like having a future in Georgia every single week for 52 weeks of the year. You know, it's like, you know, you're going to have more opportunity. You're going to, you know, people say, so for me with the kids, as far as, you know, we've tried, say in California, they have this USTA development center called Carson. You know, it's right near my house, the Home Depot Center. They built clay courts. You know, oh, we got to get our kids as good as the juniors and get them on clay. Well, you know, the climate in California is not really so good for clay courts. It's dry. You know, it takes a lot of water, a lot of, you know, to sort of create the clay courts that you get in Europe. You know, it's like, I always say, you know, if we put our funding into developing traveling teams, you know, and then how do you do that? And it's like learning a foreign language. You know, if you can get these kids in Europe, you know, there's a great system. I you know, I went through all this stuff myself in Barcelona. They have like money tournament systems with the kids where they go and they train and they play during the week. All the tennis clubs of Barcelona are pretty empty from, say, 10:30 in the morning till 4 o'clock, you know. So they have like money, like little tournaments for 13-14, but all the way up until open players, you know, playing each other, getting, you know, you can go as an American and play those tournaments and learn how to play clay court tennis against the best type of where they play the best clay court tennis in the world. You know, it's like instead of building clay courts here and getting hard court players playing a hard court player on a clay court, let's go, you know, and it's a whole way that you move, you know, even for grass. It's like, you know, how can you practice on a grass court these days? It's almost impossible so you have to basically make it, you know, to even get on grass. But, you know, playing on surfaces other than the ones you're brought up on, I think will develop, you know, a lot of people say our best athletes end up in basketball and baseball and football, and, you know, and it is a sport traditionally. I mean, I think it's great that we even have an opportunity to develop middle and lower class players. I mean, the Williamses are a great example of someone that came from, you know, but they're maybe the one in the few that did it. They didn't play junior tournaments. They did, you know, but they came through somehow. You know, they willed it. And, you know, in Italy, that you don't even think about being a tennis player unless you're in a certain income bracket, unless you can belong to a tennis club, you know. So it takes money, it takes talent, it takes perseverance to make it. You know, I've always been about thinking outside the box. You know, as far as the USPA, and I hear that they're doing things, they're allotting more money for kids to get developed or to be able to travel and learn how to play on different surfaces. I always hear there's, you know, a lot of times it's just kind of a turnover. There'll be a new person coming in and he'll have his ideas on it. And, you know, it could be that we're in a system like that. I feel like, you know, the Williamses were a little bit out of the box. They got through. Eventually an American male will get through. And we have a lot of good players. I was out, you know, there were five in the quarterfinals the other day. I mean, American tennis is just waiting. I think there's a way that we move on the hard courts. It doesn't really help us on clay and grass. And I've got my own ideas about teaching that. I think we run too hard, if you know what I mean. Like we're primarily brought up on hard courts, and there's a way to sort of move smoother and it's still explosive, but with a small first step. You know, for a long time there were guys like James Blake, you know, top 10 in the world, great side-to-side, forward and backwards, but just maybe ran a little too hard to really break through and win like a Roland Garros. I mean, it takes a lot of, you know, the competition out there is tough. Our time is coming. You know, there's so many people. It's a beautiful sport and that you can play, you know, one of the biggest things that tennis teaches you. I mean, I think it's such a great sport because it's not subjective. I mean, I'm down here, I'm signed in, I'm 45 years old, I'm signed into a $10,000 future, you know, because I still think there's that opportunity. I mean, I've walked onto tennis courts and played guys that were 6'9", you know, and been like, oh my God, I'm going to lose to this guy, you know, and then, you know, I end up winning. Or I've walked on and I've played guys 5'2", you know, and I'm like, oh God, this is going to take 15 minutes, this will be easy, and then the guy just outgrinds me and loses. There's so many different ways to hit tennis balls, and it's such a beautiful sport to watch, and the drama, and, you know, it's like a boxing match. Our time as American tennis players, will, you know, I think we're firmly rooted with the women in the game, and, you know, our college system is beautiful. You know, like, people all wish they had that. We bring these foreign kids in, and they play on our teams, you know, and it's a great diversity, and they pick up scholarships and all that. You know, I was in that, and I was always like, you know, how can we get the American scholarships for the American players? But, you know, on my college team, I had English players, German players. It kind of gave me that multi, you know, I'd never met anyone from Germany until I played on a tennis team with them. That's, you know, it's a multicultural, racial sport that we're able to all agree on. And, you know, the fact that it's not, you know, someone doesn't have to put you on your team. I mean, that's why I kind of switched over from basketball was, you know, I wasn't making all-star teams, you know, but I felt like I was better than this kid, you know, but there was no way to really prove it. With tennis, you know, you've got your results. You know, you wake up every day and you say, hey, you know, it's a new day, it's an opportunity, and you can see your growth. And I encourage all the kids and the parents out there, if they can set the goal of improving 10%, you know, each year, getting better, and, you know, some years they might jump 12% or they might fall back. So, you know, you just say, hey, I'm going to keep playing for the next 10 years. You're going to end up somewhere. You're going to get results. And it's about, for me, the sport's about, there's a time when you practice it and it comes together and you're no longer playing tennis, but tennis is kind of playing you, and you put in a long, hard hours to train, and it's sometimes not all that exciting, you know, the practices aren't, and then it'll come out in a match, and it'll make you realize that there's something bigger out there than yourself, and you'll have moments and, you know, zone experiences. You might have a ton of zone experiences, you know, your whole college. I've talked to kids that you know, in a season, they said, you know, we were playing so many matches that the ball looked like a grapefruit for about 3 or 4 weeks. You know, I was just in a different level, and I was hitting the ball, you know, and I'm like, gosh, isn't that great? And they're like, yes, it feels so good.
Yeah, that's very cool. Well, Trent, thank you so much for coming on today. At the end of our hour, and I just appreciate so much you taking time out. I know you are constantly traveling, and I'm happy we finally found a day that worked for both of us to do this.
Yeah. So,
good
I love what you're doing. You're doing the good work.
Well, thank you. And to my listeners, I want to thank you guys for tuning in. Please check out parentingaces.com. There's tons of new content on the site and some really important issues being discussed. So I hope you will all participate and help us grow this fantastic sport and keep it alive for our kids and their kids and generations to come. Thanks for being with us today. To all of you, have a great week, and I'll see you on the court.
All right, Lisa, thank you.